This episode is brought to you in part by Regent College, Vancouver, Canada. Experience God's call to a life more abundant with our 1 to 2 week summer courses. Sign up today at rgnt.net/summer.
You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden.
And I'm Kevin McLenathan. And Wade, you can't see me right now, but I've got a lamp cunningly positioned just so over my head, so I have a little halo right now.
Well, Kevin, I gotta say, you can't see this right now, but I'm actually praying for your salvation.
You know, somehow that's not much of a surprise, though I have to say I am impressed that you can both talk out loud and pray silently at the same time. That's a good party trick.
Listeners, today we're reviewing the religiously charged horror film from Rose Glass, Saint Maud.
Plus, we've got our usual weekly recommendations for you here on episode 291 of Seeing and Believing. Wade, do you want to engage in some Gregorian chant with me to lead us into the episode?
How about I give you a good kumbaya?
Dear God, here is Amanda. Well, you know that. Thank you for bringing us together, Lord. And thank you for this meal, which we gratefully receive. Bless Amanda's body, which is hurting now, but has done so many wonderful things. And bless her mind, which is shrouded in darkness. And reach out to her like you did to me. Amen.
Yes, listeners, we are here with episode 291. I gotta say, Kevin, even though we're talking about Saint Maud, it still feels a little weird because we're saying, oh, I'll pray for your salvation. Oh, I have a halo. It just feels a little odd to me. The young child who grew up in a very conservative church in me is worried about saying those things.
Are you glancing skyward, worried about any storm clouds gathering above?
Oh, man, it has been raining every day for weeks in Houston, and I am, so there probably are storm clouds above me, so who knows. Listeners, man, we're going to hop into our review of Saint Maud here in a bit, but I want to take an opportunity and just talk about our Patreon campaign, and specifically, Kevin, we have a new donor this week at the $10 level.
Yeah, we're really excited. Thanks so much to Lindsay Dunn for becoming a patron this week. We say this all the time, but it really does help us, you know, keep the show going. And it's always really nice to see somebody offer up their hard-earned cash to throw a little bit of that our way. And Lindsay actually pledged at the, like you said, the $10 a month level. That on our website, patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast. The $10 a month tier is titled An Offer You Can't Refuse. And this is that level, Wade, where she can pick once per year one movie for us to review on the air.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a pretty good level. I wonder if the fact that we did Night of the Hunter a few weeks ago maybe tipped the scales for her a little bit. That'd be interesting to hear.
Yeah, no, I'm interested in hearing about that and also getting that film from Lindsay and reviewing it on the show. It's going to be a lot of fun. And Kevin, all this has got me thinking, what could someone buy, not for $5, but what could someone buy for $10?
Well, yeah, so $10 is obviously, that's pretty high end. So that would buy you a special device that would automatically alert you when the avocados in your fridge are about to go bad. It's this very loud alarm, and then an overbearing masculine drill sergeant voice alerts you to the fact that you need to use those avocados because they're about to rot in the fridge. Nobody wants that.
You know, it would be great if the voice just said, it's guacamole time. Maybe that would just put it over the top, Kevin.
I think for $15 a month, you could probably get a version of okay. this device that would let you record your own greeting. And, you know, I think it might be kind of nice for Wade Bearden to say it's guacamole time every mm-hmm. now and then when my avocados are getting a little long in the tooth. So yeah. I don't know. I'd sign up for that.
Oh, man. I love guacamole. We love our guacamole down here in Texas. And it really is always guacamole time. So I think that for $10... that's not bad. For 15, you get the customizable alert, which is better.
I do have to say that probably we should workshop that a little bit. I think something like guacamole time's fine, but I kind of like the phrase guac o'clock. Mm. It's guac o'clock. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I mean, if you can do that for 15, that'd be amazing. I would pay 20 for it though.
Oh, avocado industry, give us a call. You know where to find us.
You know where to find us. Also, the avocado industry, you can head on over to our Patreon campaign. We will plug your avocados if you would like on the show. Listeners, hop on over to patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast. We're going to hop into our review of Rose Glass's Saint Maud. Here's the movie's official synopsis. Maud, played by Morvid Clark, is a reclusive young nurse whose impressionable demeanor causes her to pursue a pious path of Christian devotion after an obscure trauma. Now charged with the hospice care of Amanda, played by Jennifer Ely, a retired dancer ravaged by cancer, Maud's fervent faith quickly inspires an obsessive conviction that she must save her ward's soul from eternal damnation, whatever the cost. Kevin, Saint Maud is the latest in what's now become a long line of A24 horror films, especially A24 horror films with a distinctly religious bent. Given the movie's premise, this story really is right up our alley. I'm speaking mostly of the themes of spiritual obsession, faith, and even evangelism gone off the rails. So, my first question to get us started is this. Does Saint Maud, in your opinion, deserve to go on the shelf with other spiritually minded A24 classics like The Witch, Under the Skin, and Hereditary? Or does the project not live up to the standards that maybe we're used to from the studio?
Well, I mean, to be fair, the standard of living up to the spiritual horror of The Witch is that's a high standard. So
there you go.
Many, many films can be excused if they don't necessarily reach those heights, right? Like, I'm not going to, you know, look too, get too snooty about such things. I do think that Saint Maud doesn't quite manage to get that high. I certainly think it's really interesting, and there's a lot of intriguing stuff that Glass and her star Morvid Clark do with this idea of a private care nurse who soon discovers that she's much more interested in saving souls necessarily than just caring for the physical needs of her patients. So that's a really intriguing hook for a film. And I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff going on here. I think what makes some movies like The Witch as interesting as they are is the way that Robert Eggers is really able to suggest I don't know if ambiguity is the right word, because it's not necessarily ambiguous what goes on in some of these films, but there's a suggestion that the question of, is this character's spiritual obsession all in their head, or is it actually happening, isn't really the most interesting question you can be asking when you're dealing with things like spiritual obsession. There's much more interesting things you can mine, and I think movies like The Witch or even The Lighthouse, which I would count as a spiritual horror film mm-hmm. as well, the question of whether or not some of these things are literally happening or how much of it is supernatural is less interesting than, okay, well, but what is this film's vision of spirituality? What is spiritual good and spiritual evil in the world of this film? I think that Eggers' work is fascinating to think about in that light. And I think that there's maybe a disappointing lack of that kind of that interest in the spiritual in this film. There's certainly a lot of trappings, and like I said, I think there's a lot of interest there. I think it could have done with a little bit more willingness to not pigeonhole what Maud in this film, what is actually happening, and more explore, well, what does spirituality mean for her? And I think that, you know, there are certainly good things about this film, but I think that there's some things left to be desired in that area.
No, I think that's a pretty strong analysis. The movie didn't work for me. There are some interesting aspects to it, some themes and some ideas. But I got to the end and I felt like the story was lacking a bit. You've got a plot that's pretty straightforward in terms of individual becomes obsessed with a distorted spirituality and as a result takes on the mantle of a savior, quote unquote savior, the mantle of God. And that theme is explicitly talked about. At one point, the character of Amanda, who is suffering from cancer, she calls her my little savior. And I think that's a strong theme. I just didn't walk away saying to myself, wow, that was a new angle to the story. As I mentioned, though, there is a theme or two that is interesting, and I'll get into it a little bit later. But I don't know if Maud as a character is fully fleshed out. She's rather one-dimensional. She's powered by some sort of trauma. We don't really know what it is. She's powered by that trauma, and she just kind of searches for something to give her life meaning and purpose, and it just so happens to be a distorted view of Christianity, and things that aren't good happen. Like, that's just kind of it. And so just on a personal and emotional level, there wasn't a lot of connection there. And the movie, while I guess disturbing in some ways, didn't have any of that slow burn terror in a film like Under the Skin, or even a movie that I didn't like too much, but I admire in many ways, The Lighthouse or The Witch. There's this terror, this spiritual alienation. And this one just, it felt like a shell of those movies, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think part of the issue here is that what's going on with Maud, her religious beliefs are, as presented in this film, are pretty much indistinguishable from some form of mental illness. Like if the screenplay was changed so that instead of talking about instead of being very religiously observant, if Maud were, you know, schizophrenic or were suffering from some sort of mental disorder that caused her to experience visions or hear voices, the film would more or less remain unchanged. It would be more or less the same movie. And I think that's it's a minor problem. I don't think it's necessarily fatal. I guess it sounds like I maybe like this film a little bit more than you did, but it does suggest a disappointing lack of imagination, that there's so much that could have been done with this premise. Instead, it kind of just feels like, well, this is the film is satisfied with the answer that this is a disturbed person who's dealing with a lot of trauma, perhaps some mental illness issues, and that's really all there is to it. And that's just, it's not satisfying given especially the fact that some of the themes of religious obsession, of the ways that religious devotion can sometimes take on kind of the psychosexual dimension. Like those are interesting things to explore. I just don't think that the film ends up being as interested in them as it hints at in these early scenes. And that almost seems suggested by the fact that For Maud, she says kind of her patron saint is Mary Magdalene, and it feels like Glass chose that religious figure because Magdalene is, among other things, famous for being, you know, kind of the one of the first messengers of the resurrection. So she's kind of this true believer. Lots of people don't believe her, and there's also she's unjustly been saddled as kind of like there's a sexual element to her character in tradition, not in the Bible, that is kind of in the popular imagination around her. And it seems like a more fitting saint for this particular character would be something like Teresa of Avila, who, you know, did kind of experience this ecstasy in her religious experiences. But it seems like the film just kind of reaches for a much more widely known, famous religious figure, and kind of is satisfied with the surface level associations that a lot of viewers will have with that. And that seems a little bit emblematic as a whole of its attitude towards religion as a whole, maybe.
Well, and here's where I found the greatest interest in this movie. And it's the idea of organized religion. In the movie, Maud is given a book of William Blake's work. And we hear her voiceover, which is her prayer. She talks about how William Blake just had this disdain for organized religion and claimed that it was a distortion of a true spiritual life. And what struck me about that angle is Maud's character definitely seems like an individual who has taken that route, who has completely bypassed Christian community. And as a result, she expects to hear from God on her own without tradition or church leadership or church community helping her in that direction. And it comes back to hurt her. And so with the movie, I was thinking about that and then thinking about The Witch and perhaps even The Lighthouse, of how those movies, regardless of how the directors, the writers feel about organized religion, those movies seem to suggest that organized religion is actually good. Because at the beginning of The Witch, the family is cast out of their community. And as a result of being cast out, problems come. Isolation happens in The Lighthouse. This woman is, Maud here, is outside of any sort of bounds of authority or friendship. And because of that, her trauma gets the best of her. And so I walked away not really knowing, and maybe this is a good thing, walked away not really knowing what this film has to say about Christianity. If it's saying, oh, well, people, you know, take faith and they distort it, and that's why there are problems in our world, or saying that we need each other as we interpret the scriptures and interpret the Bible. It's just kind of a fascinating angle. And so for me, I enjoy just kind of pondering that, because if you look at Maud, she has isolated herself and she's alone, and that ultimately hurts her. It starves her faith rather than feeding it, like you would, you know, think from the work of William Blake. So I found that to be a fascinating angle.
The evocation of William Blake in this film is maybe one of the things I find more interesting, because Blake's vision of spirituality is fascinating. Just the way that he views organized religion, and the way that that he kind of repudiated one mode of spiritual experience in favor of another, and the form that his religious ideas took is this. You know, it's very in one sense, it's very weird. to use a word, it's grand, and it's ornate, and it's bizarre. It's mystical, and I kind of, maybe that's why I came away from this film kind of expecting a little bit more from it, because you know, when you're evoking Blake, you're really kind of signaling that you're ready to really get wild and woolly with the, you know, the spiritual experience here, the religious imagery and such. And it kind of feels like the film doesn't quite want to go in that direction. There's a point in the film where a character says, "God isn't real. You do know that, right?" And basically intimates that whatever expressions of spirituality she gave earlier were kind of just not really fully sincere. Like, nobody really believes in this stuff, right? And it's hard not to feel like Rose Glass and the film kind of agrees with this character in that moment. And that's not necessarily an invalid tack for a film to take, but it just seems like for most of its running time, the film is really trying to go in the opposite direction by suggesting that maybe there is something to Maud's experience of God. As warped as it is, there's something real and literal happening there. And it's just disappointing to see the film pull back on that, either because it sees it as a twist, or because it simply lacks the courage to really lend any credence to that sort of religious belief.
Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of fascinating line where Maud talks about taking care of the dead, the dying, mopping up after them. And she says it's nothing compared to saving, quote unquote, saving a soul. And it's one of those, it's in that section of the movie where I feel like the film kind of tips its hand as well, where it's, oh, well, why is religion so concerned with conversion and not necessarily concerned with, you know, these other issues? And I think that's a valid point that we all need to ask ourselves. What type of faith is our faith? Is it one that serves widows and orphans, or is it one that's just trying to help people escape Earth? But the film never delves into that other than this sort of quick comment. And it goes back to the almost ambiguity you talked about, in that the film doesn't wade into the complexities of what's happening here. And there are some fascinating angles and shots. The character of Amanda, she was a choreographer, a famous, I guess, dance instructor. She perhaps even did some dancing. And now her spinal cord has cancer all over it. So obviously the film's kind of connecting those two things together in a way. And we get some hand movements. We get sort of this physicality as these characters are doing therapy. And I found it to be sort of fascinating. Later, we get basically sex is connected to CPR, and I'm interested in what the movie is saying about physicality and spirituality, and how those two mesh together. How does the spiritual meet the physical world? And so there were glimpses there, which I appreciate. That was one of the other angles that I enjoyed. But just kind of wanting more, and also just, you know, wanting more from the story itself and where this character goes and what happens to this individual. Because I feel like the movie does kind of languish in some territory for a bit, and it doesn't necessarily, I think, conclude in a satisfactory way.
I wonder if this is an example of where, you know, quote unquote prestige horror could maybe benefit from being a little bit more willing to get a little gnarly and a little bit more gory, really going into the genre conventions of horror, because that angle that you mentioned, the tension between the spirit and the body, and how, especially with religious devotion, how that can take many forms. You see Maud in some scenes abuse herself. She has scars on her torso, presumably from self-harm. There's a scene where she intentionally burns herself on a hot stove. There's other scenes where she sort of does, shall we say, uncomfortable things to her injuries that are, they're a little bit stomach turning. You kind of sense that this is a version of the mortification of the flesh, right? The monks who would scourge themselves to purify themselves of worldly or bodily desires. And you get a sense that maybe this movie is trying to say something about how when Maud takes a turn towards this rejection of the flesh and more into these mystical religious visions she's been having, that maybe she loses her way a little bit. I think that part of the problem is that the film doesn't really flesh those out. I mean, pardon the pun, but it doesn't really flesh those elements out enough. There's scenes where we get a little bit hints of the sort of body horror that you might expect out of a Cronenberg film, but they're very brief. They're kind of flashes, and then it's back to these quick flashes of religious visions that Maud is having, and it's difficult to know how much the movie really wants us to take such religious experiences seriously. Does it intend for us to see Maud's self-inflicted injuries as a spiritual experience for her, or more just kind of this is a symptom of her disintegrating grasp on reality and on who she is and what her role is? It's a little bit unclear, and that's probably because the film pulls its punches when maybe it should lean into that a little bit more and, find the meaning in that suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I definitely agree and think there's a lot here. And I think the production design is pretty good. I like the gloomy house that Maud goes to serve Amanda as she works for her.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels like death has already come in a way, if that makes sense. So it's not this, she's just waiting to die. It's like it's kind of there hovering over her. And I think that's pretty effective among some other things. But yeah, overall, I think the movie could have used a little bit more. Listeners, that is our review of Saint Maud. It's currently streaming. If you have Amazon Prime, you can stream Saint Maud today. Make sure to let us know what you think at CBelievePod on Twitter, at CBelievePod. You can also email us, seeingandbelieving@gmail.com.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Kevin, we've reached the part of the show where we recommend something from the world of television and or film to our listeners. What would you like to recommend to our listeners today?
Well, I was thinking about other films where there's obsession involved, and specifically obsession that if it isn't spiritual, is at least mystical in some way. And I also was thinking about this St. Maud's use of, a little bit of body horror, some uncomfortable physical imagery. And that naturally led me towards Darren Aronofsky's debut feature in 1998, the film Pi. This is a, shoestring indie shot on black and white film stock. Just very striking, really just an incredibly impressive debut feature from Aronofsky here. But this is a movie about a mathematical genius who thinks he's discovered some sort of key in the digits of pi, 3.1415, etc. that allow him to kind of unlock the fabric of reality. He thinks he can maybe see the future or can understand reality on a level that most people can't, thanks to his understanding of this number. And of course, there's elements of body horror in this film as well. He kind of, as the film goes on, he encounters Jewish mystics who also wants to understand what he's seen in Pi. He begins to lose his own grasp on reality. And this being Aronofsky, of course, there's just some absolutely stunning / stomach turning sound design to really reflect this. It's, you know, it's a little rough around the edges, but it's still so striking, and I think would make a very compelling double feature with Saint Maud if anyone has the time to watch both back to back. So if any listeners have the time and the stomach for that exercise, I'd love to hear what that's like for them. But otherwise, it would be pretty fine on its own. 1998's Pi from Darren Aronofsky.
I have yet to see it. I want to see it, but it also feels like one of those movies that I wouldn't, like, I would appreciate, but not necessarily enjoy. So I haven't seen it yet.
I'll say this, you know, Requiem for a Dream is pretty famously one of those movies that is just a great movie and you also never want to see it again after you finish it. Pi isn't quite as hard of a sit as that movie, if that helps at all.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I haven't seen Requiem for a Dream either because of that reason. It's like, you know, long work week, it's Friday night, you're like, let's pop in, you know, a movie about drugs and how it destroys people's lives.
It's a tough sell. Can't blame you.
I feel like, Kevin, so I'm kind of changing this up a little bit. I like to change it up a bit. And my recommendation segment is actually just kind of a mini review. And you said tough sell. Zack Snyder has a new movie out called Army of the Dead. And that's kind of a tough sell for me. But randomly, one night, I just decided to turn this on because I do like zombie pictures and it seemed like it could be kind of, you know, light. And I do have to say, this is not Snyder's worst film. This is not his best film either. So this is a story about a zombie outbreak in Las Vegas. The city is quarantined off and a crew comes together. The crew's led by Dave Bautista. And they are attempting to break into a casino vault before the city is destroyed by a nuclear bomb. So it's got this really big story. As with most Snyder films, there are some pretty thought-provoking and even beautiful images. But I don't know if Snyder has found a way yet to harness those to the credit of the story or to influence the story or to invoke anything more than a passing feeling or any thematic ideas. It happens here. I don't really like what he does with classic music. He takes classic music, he puts them in a lot of different scenes, and I just don't feel like he respects the songs. And in the end, the movie is unsatisfying. I didn't have a good time. I figured I'd offer just a quick review in case our listeners were wondering. We're not going to have a chance to review it, but that is currently playing on Netflix if individuals would like to check it out. Me, I just really didn't have a fun time.
Well, I know that, you know, film spotting every now and then, or at least I'm a little bit behind on my listening, but I know there was a time when they had little mini segments where Josh Larson would just offer his thoughts solo on a film that he'd seen, whether or not he recommended it. So maybe we can make that a semi-regular thing with Wade, you know, mini reviews with Wade or something on Seeing and Believing.
Well, I watched this movie, which is 2.5 hours long. So I was like, I gotta make up for it somehow, right? Like, why not just let our listeners know? And I feel like I didn't completely waste 2.5 hours.
Oh man, I feel for you. I was waffling on this one because I don't like Zack Snyder. I don't need to belabor that. Listeners already know that. But I was thinking, you know, like, It Dawn of the Dead is widely regarded as Snyder's best movie, and he's returning to, you know, kind of a zombie movie milieu for this one. I thought, okay, well, maybe, I don't know, maybe this one will be a little bit less annoying than a lot of his other films. And then I saw that runtime. I was like, nope, not worth it to me. So mm-hmm. I appreciate you taking one for the team on that one. Where I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, don't go with your whims, people. If you're coming across a movie on Netflix, you're like, that doesn't look good, I might just start it. Just don't do it. Turn on something else. Well, listeners, that is our episode. Once again, you can tweet us at SeeBelievePod on Twitter at SeeBelievePod. You can also email us seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com. Thank you for checking out this week's episode. It's brought to you, as always, by ChristInPopCulture.com. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden. My co-host is Kevin McLenathan. And until next time, this is Seeing and Believing. We'll see you later.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at ChristInPopCulture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.